she could go back.
Hey!
Dash's voice cut through the silence as he yelled from below, Come on, we need you! The moment was over. The filming was very quick. All that was needed was for Hayes to recite the truly devious letter while walking down the tunnel length. He and Maris passed the camera back and forth to get some long shots, but it was dark and cold and hard to film, and time was not on their side. At 8:30, they all crept back to the steps. A quick look outside showed that no one was waiting for them to pop out of the hole. The doors were closed.
We can't all go together,
Hayes said, holding the padlock in his hand.
If anyone sees us all coming from this direction, they might realize we were down here. Nate, Stevie, you guys go first. Dash, you should go the other way around. Maris, we can go last.
As Stevie and Nate walked back through the dark, Nate glanced over his shoulder.
I think they're going to go back and bone in that tunnel, he said.
Bone, Stevie repeated. Did you have to say bone?
Tunnel boner,
Nate said.
A new fragrance for men.
They wouldn't, Stevie said. They won't.
Why not?
Because that's the tunnel. You don't just tunnel bone in that tunnel.
Sometimes a tunnel is just a tunnel,
Nate said. Stevie ground her jaw a bit and walked on, her hands deep in her hoodie pockets. The magic of the tunnel and the observatory was still on her, and she wanted to hold it as long as possible. She thought of the letter that she had seen on her wall. It really had been so vivid. Dreams had a way of blurring and fading the moment they were over. The edges were sharp on this, the colors bright. Her mind had taken a screenshot. Had it been real? It was possible. Most things are possible. It wasn't likely, though. What was likely was that her anxious and excited brain, full of new stimuli, conjured up something bright and shiny for her. Something so magical and odd that it stamped its impression on her brain cells for a little longer than normal. Thinking about it logically, who knew or cared enough about her to go to those kinds of lengths, and to what end? It had been a dream. Just as Janelle said, Janelle made sense. Still, the feeling was there, and it felt like Truly Devious was calling out from the past. Truly Devious, the known ghoul, the laughing murderer. But some things don't stay buried. Not tunnels, not secrets. Truly Devious was not immune. Who is Truly Devious, 80 years on? PostDetective.com April 13, 2016. On April 8, 1936, a letter arrived at the Burlington, Vermont office of Albert Ellingham. Albert Ellingham was, at the time, one of the richest men in America. He constructed an estate and a school in the mountains outside of Burlington, and it was there he lived with his wife and his daughter, breathing the sweet, clean air. A Burlington office collected his personal and business mail. And every day, a car would take sacks of correspondence from Burlington to the house, well up on Mount Hatchet, where it would be sorted and processed by his secretary. That day, in with the hundreds of letters, one stood out. The envelope was postmarked from Burlington. The address of the Ellingham estate was written on the front in dull pencil, in heavy, square strokes. Inside was a single piece of writing paper that contained the words, Look, a riddle, time for fun. Should we use a rope or gun? Knives are sharp and gleam so pretty. Poison's slow, which is a pity. Fire is festive, drowning's slow. Hanging's a ropey way to go. A broken head, a nasty fall, a car colliding with a wall. Bombs make a very jolly noise. Such ways to punish naughty boys. What shall we use? We can't decide, just like you cannot run or hide. Ha ha, truly devious. Threats to Albert Ellingham and his family were not new. In fact, Albert Ellingham had barely survived a car bombing several years before. This was during a time in which industrialists were often under threat. What made this letter so different? For a start, it was constructed of colorful words and letters that would later be determined to come from popular magazines. In bright, cheerful print, it spelled out a diabolical poem, one that listed the many ways that Albert Ellingham might die. The letter writer gave themselves a name, Truly Devious. 5 days later, while out on a drive, Albert Ellingham's wife, Iris, was kidnapped along with their 3-year-old daughter, Alice. Along with Iris and Alice, a young girl named Dolores Epstein, who was a student at Ellingham's new academy on the site, also vanished. A ransom demand was called in that evening, giving Albert Ellingham just a few minutes to bundle up the money in his safe and take it to a lake on his property. Ellingham was a bit short of cash, so the kidnappers beat up the person sent to collect Iris and Alice and demanded more. Robert McKenzie, Ellingham's 30-year-old private secretary, begged to call the police, but Ellingham was convinced that doing so would put his family in more danger. Instead, along with family friend George Marsh by his side, Ellingham took $200,000 in marked bills to a remote point in Burlington and lowered the money down to a boat waiting below on Lake Champlain. The boat sailed off. On May 16, 1936, Dolores Epstein's body was found in a field in Jericho, Vermont, in a shallow grave. She was discovered by a milk truck driver from a local dairy who had pulled off the road to relieve a call of nature. The cause of death was a massive blow to the head. 3 weeks later, on June 5, 1936, the body of Iris Ellingham washed up near South Hero, Vermont. Maud Loomis, the local resident who discovered the body, stated, "She was wrapped in an oilcloth and she was in bad shape, real bad shape. It looked like they tried to weigh her down." Iris's body was found to have 3 gunshot wounds. Truly Devious seemed to be running down the list. There was a car involved, though it didn't go into the wall. In fact, Iris Ellingham's cherry red Mercedes was eventually found neatly parked deep on a country lane, 7 miles from the house, with no sign of a struggle. There was a broken head, a gun, and a body found in water. The FBI was called in 3 days after the kidnapping. Agents immediately took possession of the letter and started their examination. Specialists determined that the paper was of an ordinary stock, sold in thousands of stores. The only fingerprints on the letter were those of Albert Ellingham and Robert McKenzie. The paste was basic white glue. The words and letters came from popular publications such as Life magazine, Photoplay, and the Saturday Evening Post. In short, there was nothing remarkable about the letter aside from its content. Psychiatrists from all around the country had opinions on the identity of the letter writer. There were differing thoughts on the exact diagnosis, but all agreed that the writer was intelligent, highly verbal, and confident. Poets and literature professors examined the poem with massively differing opinions. Some said the work was childish. Others said the poem was written by someone who knew poetry well, who was hiding their talent. One surrealist chillingly called it the truest, greatest work of our time. This presented a bit of a problem at the trial. While Anton Voracek had some of the ransom money in his house and admitted to the crime, his English was extremely limited. Most experts involved in the case thought he was incapable of writing the letter, though one FBI specialist disagreed. 2 years after Voracek's death, a woman claimed that he had been with her on the day of the crime, but that she had been too frightened to come forward earlier. Her account was widely disputed. 80 years on, the questions linger. With modern technology, we might be able to learn more about the Truly Devious letter. But there is a problem. It no longer exists. The letter was taken to the Burlington courthouse for the trial. A week after the trial concluded, there was a fire in the courthouse basement, most likely caused by a smoldering cigarette. 12 boxes of evidence were destroyed before the fire was extinguished, including the box containing Truly Devious's work. So we are likely never to know Truly Devious's secrets. Ha ha, as they might say. 15. Want to hear something weird? Janelle said as she stood in Stevie's doorway. Stevie was still in bed, her phone alarm chirping, telling her that even though it was early Saturday morning, it was time to get up and shoot a video with Hayes. She wiped her eyes and looked at Janelle, who looked as perturbed as anyone can look while wearing baby blue fleece pajamas covered in cat heads. This is what's weird, she said. She lifted up her arm, and hanging from her fist was an Ellingham lanyard with an ID dangling at the end. Guess where it was? Stevie had no guess. Literally outside, on the path. Someone took my pass and then brought it back, but not even all the way to the building. They could have shoved it in the door or something. Instead, they dropped it halfway up the path. Who does that?
Someone playing a prank, Stevie said, rubbing at her short hair. An asshole?
Definitely the last one, Janelle said. At least I have it back. Crisis averted. With that mystery resolved, if not solved, Stevie got herself showered and dressed. The air was crisp, so Stevie put on her sweats and her Ellingham fleece. As she went into the common room, she was shocked to see David awake, in pajama bottoms and an old t-shirt from a surfing brand, sitting cross-legged on the purple sofa, hunkered over his computer.
Are you working? She said.
He looked up. His eyes were red, like he had not slept, and there was shade around his jawline. His curly hair stood on end. He looked tumbled and attractive.
I go here, he said. Remember?
Do you? Stevie said coolly, walking to the kitchen. Had she just thought David was attractive? Could he tell? It was acceptable to have the thought, but not for him to know, and somehow he would know. She filled her aluminum Ellingham bottle with coffee and left the house quickly, even before Nate came down. It was an aggressively pretty morning, as if the season wanted to show off before everything went to pieces and the trees got naked and everything died. The sky was big and blue. Stevie had a real sense of purpose and lift as she made her way over to the sunken garden. This felt like going to school, she thought, as she looked around Ellingham. Up early on a fresh Saturday morning, coffee in hand to make a project. The energy of the tunnel was still with her. The door to the sunken garden was open, and Stevie stepped inside. There was no one there yet, so she took a moment to sit with her coffee and look. Stevie was well aware that this man-made lake was large, but when you saw it in person, saw this massive crater in the earth, it brought home just what Albert Ellingham was willing to do to make his family happy. His wife loved to swim, so the ground was leveled, the rock blown away. When he got a tip suggesting that his wife and daughter or some evidence rested at the bottom, the lake was drained and dried and the earth scarred. And now just the monuments remained. The statues that looked over the void. The observatory ridiculous on its little bump.
Thanks for waiting,
said Nate, coming in from behind her. Sorry, she said. He was wearing cargo shorts, despite the fact that there was a little chill in the air, and a t-shirt that said, My other car is a dragon.
You really love this stuff, don't you?
He said, sitting down next to her on the damp grass.
It's like you're at Murder Disney World.
Murder Disney World would be amazing.
That's true, he said. I'd go to that too.
It's just... Stevie looked for the words. I've seen so many pictures of this place. I've read all this stuff. It was like everything I had in my head is... She waved her hands helplessly in front of her. Luckily, Nate seemed to understand.
Yeah,
Nate said.
I guess it would be like that if I could go somewhere in a book. I always wanted stories to be real, so I started writing my own. That seemed to make it more real. I'm kind of jealous you get to see your thing. Gandalf isn't coming for me.
Never say never, Stevie said. There was the modest sound of a golf cart coming, and Mark from maintenance drove in with their supplies, with Dash along for the ride. Hayes and Maris arrived last, and though they weren't holding hands, They walked close enough together and looked at each other in a way that made it clear that they had not parted ways right away last night. There was a lot of moving things that day. Lots of running and fetching. Janelle's beloved poles were set into stands on which lights were attached. The ramp was placed into the sunken garden to create a place from which Hayes could row his imaginary boat. There was a generator to power the lights and the fog machines, which required lots of positioning and testing. Then the tripods were set, lights focused. It took hours, and it was boring. Nate and Stevie had little to do but obey commands to hold things and move things and get things. As Stevie and Nate went from the garden to the costume closet and back again, Stevie noted that Hayes didn't seem to be doing a lot of running or holding or moving. He sat on a stone bench most of the time, looking at his computer. Stevie thought he was running his lines. The lines were all his. This was a monologue. The rest of the dialogue would be recorded separately and put on top as narration, so there was a lot to know. When she did a quick pass behind him, she saw he was looking at pictures and replying to messages. While the ramp was being positioned for the fifth time, Stevie noticed that they had been joined by someone new. Jermaine Bat had slipped in through the gate and was floating around and heading in Hayes's direction. Stevie wondered how this would play out, considering that Jermaine had taken footage of Hayes the other night without his knowledge and posted it. But he seemed to welcome Jermaine and even posed for some pictures. Stevie also noted that he made himself look very busy in those pictures. There was a short lunch break, during which Hayes disappeared for a bit back to Minerva to put on his makeup. When everything was finally in place, hours later, he was nowhere to be found.
"Where the hell did he go?" Dash asked, looking around. "Stevie, can you find him?"
Stevie had been sitting on her bag, trying to get enough of a signal on her phone to download the latest episode of her new favorite true crime podcast, Speaking of Murder.
"Oh," she said, getting up. "Yeah, sure."
She wandered around the empty lake, around the edges of the garden. She heard voices coming from the folly by the back wall. She approached and heard a female voice, an angry one at that.
"You're so full of shit, Hayes," it said. "You owe me."
"And I'll give it to you," Hayes replied.
"That's what you said before."
"Because I will."
Stevie remained very still for a moment and listened.
"You think people don't know?"
the unknown person said, her voice dripping with contempt.
"Know what, Gretchen?"
Hayes said. "Gretchen. The girl with the hair. The queenly one."
"Oh, please. You're going to pretend with me?"
"Why do you even care?"
he said.
"Well, first, I'm never getting paid back. Let's not pretend about that. You do this to everyone. To me, probably to Beth. At least she knows now, thanks to that girl who did the video. What about these dumb SOBs who are out here doing your work right now?"
Dumb SOBs? Stevie was one of those dumb SOBs.
"Gretchen."
It came out as a long sigh.
"What if I tell that girl with the show all about it?"
"I guess you do what you need to do, Gretchen,"
he said.
"Or you could take a Xanax and give me a week or two."
Before Stevie could move, Hayes came from around the back of the folly. It was clearly Hayes, but he was older. His hair was grayed and his face was full of lines and furrows. Maris had done a good job with the stage makeup.
"Hey, Stevie,"
he said a little louder than necessary.
"Hey," she said. "It's time."
Hayes smiled a bit, and Stevie realized he thought she was providing him cover to get out of the conversation. Now that she had been labeled as a dumb SOB who was doing Hayes's work for him, Stevie regarded his expression with a lot more suspicion.
"Thanks,"
he said, his voice thickening and sweeting. "Tupelo honey now." Gretchen emerged as well. She saw Stevie, but to paraphrase Sherlock Holmes, she did not observe. Stevie was a part of the landscape. She strode past without a word.
"Thanks,"
Hayes said, dropping a slow arm over Stevie's shoulders.
"My ex. I mean, she broke up with me, and she still seems mad about it. It's strange, but you know how these things are."
Stevie did not know how these things were, but she nodded.
It's tough, she said. Hayes nodded and slipped into a deeper, more comfortable smile. Hayes had a smile like a hammock. Just get in, go to sleep, forget your troubles and cares. A few things Stevie quickly learned that afternoon. One, shooting the video involved a lot of not shooting the video, and standing around and talking about doing things again, and then sometimes doing them again, and then running to the bathroom to find that things were just about where they were before. Two, Hayes really could act. There was no denying him that. Three, theatrical fog stank. And four, it was possible for Stevie to tire of standing in the sunken garden and listen to the Ellingham kidnapping story being hashed over and over. As the hours rolled on, she started to resent the fact that she had allowed Hayes to take Truly Devious as a subject. Sure, she had agreed, but there was something wrong about this, about making this weird little video. And though Hayes was doing a good enough job, and no matter how well the makeup was applied, he was still a 17-year-old guy playing a man in his late 40s. This was Stevie's thing, and something about the whole filming process felt sideways and wrong in a way she could not quite place. By 6, Maris said they'd probably gotten what they needed, and Dash called a dinner break.
We'll eat, and then we'll come back and clean up, he said. Tonight?
Nate replied.
Can't we do it tomorrow?
Maris was helping Hayes wipe his face with a makeup remover cloth. When they were done, the group made their way out of the garden and to the dining hall. Stevie heard Nate's stomach grumbling out loud. As they reached the green, Hayes took a step back.
You guys go ahead,
he said.
There's something I forgot.
I'll come, Maris said.
No, it's cool,
he said, walking backward.
Go ahead and save me a place.
Stevie and Nate didn't have to be told twice. It was strangely disconcerting to sit with a different group for dinner. Stevie worked her way through a plate of fried chicken and corn, watching across the room as some of her housemates reconfigured into groups. There was Janelle, taking a seat with some people from Vi's building. Ellie sat with people Stevie had barely seen before. David never showed up at all. Nor did Hayes.
I wonder what's taking him so long, Maris said, fidgeting in her seat. He's not answering his texts.
He's probably on the phone,
Dash said, quickly eating some mashed potatoes. Maris sat on her hands and glanced around the room, her gaze landing on Gretchen as she entered the dining hall. She ran her tongue over her teeth.
I should go check, she said.
Maris, he's coming, Dash said. He's just doing something.
We should go back and move the ramp anyway.
Oh my God, Dash said. Fine, just let me finish eating for a second.
Gretchen turned ever so casually toward them, her gaze passing like a cloud overhead. What had she and Hayes been talking about earlier? What did Hayes owe Gretchen? And did being associated with Hayes cause this kind of turmoil? Maris was nervous. All of them were working on something that really benefited Hayes. Gretchen was literally seeking some kind of retribution. How did some people lead these kinds of lives? Dinner was finished quickly, much to Nate's chagrin, and the four of them, Maris, Dash, Stevie, and Nate, made their way back to the sunken garden. It was just now coming on nightfall, the sky turning an electric blue with the trees standing out in stark relief. As they walked, Stevie heard someone approaching briskly, then turned to see Jermaine Bat next to her.
Where are you guys going? She asked.
To the sunken garden, Nate said. To move a ramp or something. I don't know. I thought I just had to write.
Can I come?
You want to move a ramp? Stevie said.
It's everyone's dream,
Nate said, tugging his backpack higher on his shoulders.
Come to Ellingham Academy. Move a ramp out of a hole in the dark.
I just want to see what you're doing, Jermaine said.
More Hayes news, Stevie said.
I got 50,000 views on that last one.
That would be good on a tombstone, Stevie said. I got 50,000 views on that last one.
Say what you want, Jermaine said, a frosty edge in her voice. I honestly don't care.
When people say they honestly don't care, they care.
Jermaine hadn't done anything to Stevie. There was no reason to be spiky with her. Sure, it was a little unsavory what she was doing, but it didn't seem to be hurting Hayes any. If anything, he literally had a new girlfriend running after him right now in front of them in the gathering dark.
Sorry, Stevie said.
Just kidding.
It's fine, Jermaine replied crisply.
It did not seem fine. The last lightning bugs of the season were dancing over the lawn as they entered through the gate. The hole in the ground looked a bit more ominous in the dark, and the dirty glass of the observatory caught the rising moon. There were piles of poles and folded tarps and the ramp.
Hayes? Maris called.
No reply. An unseen bird rustled in the treetops overhead.
Where is he? Maris said.
Who knows? Dash said. He's probably on the phone somewhere and left us with this to clean up. Come on.
He's got to be here somewhere, Maris said. Hayes!
Her bright operatic voice rang from end to end of the garden.
You'll figure this out fast, Dash said, picking up some poles. Hayes is never around to do the dishes.
Maris shifted around, and for the first time, Stevie saw a first year like herself. Someone who'd fallen for someone fast and was rapidly realizing things were not equal on both sides. On their return home that evening, Nate went right to his room. Stevie decided to sit in the hammock chair in the common room and wait for Hayes to return. She could not fully explain why she did this. Maybe it was irritation. Maybe it had something to do with the tunnel. Had Hayes gone back there? Why had he turned like that and gone off on his own so deliberately? Whatever the case, the hammock chair was a good place to sit and watch some episodes of Stormy Weather. She had earned them. The hours passed. 9 became 10, which was when Janelle returned, her face flushed.
Hey,
she said, dropping to the floor by Stevie's feet with a wide grin.
I was just doing some work with Vi. I saw you brought my poles back.
I'll always have your pole. Stevie said. And working with Vi?
Studying, said Janelle. In the yurt.
Yurt studying?
Janelle smacked Stevie's shins playfully with the cord of her headphones.
I'll get my stuff, Janelle said. I'll sit with you.
10 became 10:30. Curfew was 11, and there was no Hayes yet. Stevie began to think more about the tunnel. Hayes had clearly been in it before. Was it stable? It had been packed with dirt for many decades. It had been through all kinds of weather. It was locked. There were cracks. What if he'd gone down alone? What if it had gone down on his head? No, Hayes was just being Hayes. He wasn't with Maris, though. Maybe he was with Gretchen? It didn't matter where he was, so why was she so anxious? Because she had anxiety. Pix also moved into the common room wearing a flowing pair of cotton pants and a black tank top showing off her muscular arms as she knitted away and watched a documentary on her computer. Ellie and David floated in at just before 11, both grinning. They dropped onto the sofa together.
So,
David said to Stevie.
Exciting Saturday night?
What's the matter? Ellie said. You look kind of freaked out.
Before Stevie could reply, Pix pulled off her headphones and looked at the group.
Anyone know where Hayes is?
She asked.
He's about to be late.
Everyone else replied in the negative. Stevie decided to look blank and ignore the question. Pix pulled out her phone and started texting. Stevie felt the electric zing of anxiety shoot down her arms. He would come in at any second. He was just being stupid. Don't mention the tunnel. It would get everyone into trouble, probably for no reason. 11 became 11:30.
I hate calling Larry because people are late, she said. He's not answering my texts.
He didn't tell anyone where he was?
Stevie felt a vein beating in her forehead. Look, Stevie said. I don't know where Hayes went. I don't. But a couple nights ago, we went in the tunnel. David and Ellie jerked their heads up at this. Janelle had headphones on and did not hear.
You need to be more specific, Pix said. There are a lot of tunnels.
The one under the sunken garden?
That one is filled in,
Pix said. Not anymore, Stevie said. It was fine, but I don't know. Maybe he went back there?
Are you kidding me?
Pix said.
Oh, God.
10 minutes later, Larry was at the door of Minerva.
Mark is already on his way to the tunnel,
he said to Pix.
Stevie, coat on. Come with me.
A few minutes later, Stevie was out in the cold alongside Larry, their breath puffing out in front of them, their flashlights making long, dancing dots on the ground.
I knew someone would try to get in there,
Larry said, gesturing for Stevie to get into the waiting golf cart.
I knew we should have welded it shut.
Stevie wrapped her arms tight around herself as the cart rumbled down the path.
At least you had the sense to tell us,
Larry said.
Jesus.
It was fine, Stevie said, though her voice sounded small. It seemed okay.
That thing isn't sound,
Larry said.
It probably wasn't sound when it was built, and 80 years of burial couldn't have helped. I told them to seal it. If he's not in there, we're going to go around to everywhere else you've been working, because I am going to find him and talk to him. Jesus, that tunnel.
Stevie's heart began to thud as they drove along. They met another cart containing Mark and the nurse, Ms. Hicks, as they drove alongside the garden wall, then around into the woods. They parked on the dirt maintenance road.
Stay here,
Larry said to Stevie. Mark hopped out of his cart with a hard hat on. Ms. Hicks was wearing a large puffer coat and had a fluorescent orange emergency bag over her shoulder. The three moved into the woods. Stevie huddled inside of her coat.
Hatch is unlocked,
Larry said. It groaned as he pulled the door open. He started down the steps, shining his tactical flashlight into the space.
Hayes,
he shouted.
Hayes, speak up if you're in there.
No reply.
I'm going in,
he said to Mark.
Stand by.
The dark crowded around Stevie. Her fingers started to go numb from the tips down. Alone, in this cart under the thick dome of trees, Stevie felt a creeping dread. The kind that comes from cold, untamed spaces and uninterrupted dark and trouble that had no name. There would be trouble tonight. How did they punish people at Ellingham? Why was the night so wide? What the hell lived in the trees and undergrowth that made that much rustling? Did bats attack the heads of people in golf carts? A shout pierced her devolving thoughts. It was Larry.
Mary? Mark, call 911, tell them we need the chopper!
The words hit her like a bolt. Ms. Hicks hurried into the tunnel. Mark stepped into a clearing to make the call. Stevie got out of the cart, taking every step deliberately, slowly, as though the ground itself might give way, and moved toward the opening in the ground. She heard muffled voices now. They were deep inside the tunnel, and something was very wrong. She didn't have her big flashlight, but her phone was in her pocket, so she used that as a light. Carefully, with an ever-increasing pulse, she climbed down the steps. She could hear feverish conversation deep within. They were all the way down in the liquor room. Stevie stepped forward like she was walking into a dream, her tiny light guiding the way. She ignored everything Larry had said about the instability of the tunnel. Something was happening, and some force was pulling her in to face some grim unknown. As she approached the door, she heard the nurse use the words, unresponsive, cold, cyanotic. Larry turned and flashed his light on her as she approached. What happened? Stevie heard herself ask. Larry walked toward her. He did not run. You ran when you needed help. You walked when you had to start carefully containing the scene. Larry's powerful flashlight was pointed down, focused on something on the ground. A mass, unmoving. It took a moment for Stevie to register that the thing was Hayes. His feet toward the door. He was in a semi-fetal position, one leg outstretched. His skin was a purple blue.
Stevie,
Larry said, blocking the door with his body. But she had seen all she needed to. You know death when you see it. 16. Shock is a funny thing. Things get both sharp and fuzzy. Time stretches and distorts. Things come rushing into focus and seem larger than they are,
Other things vanished to a single point.
Come with me,
Larry said, turning Stevie by the shoulders gently and leading her out of the tunnel and back to the cart.
He's dead,
Stevie said, looking up at the sky and taking a deep breath of cool air.
Hayes is dead.
Larry continued to lead her toward the cart for a moment before speaking. He settled her into the passenger's seat and looked her in the face.
Are you okay?
He asked.
Just tell me if I'm right.
Larry exhaled slowly.
He's dead,
he said.
Why?
She asked. She sounded simple, like a child.
I don't know,
Larry said.
Do you? What was he doing down there tonight, Stevie? You need to tell me.
I don't know, Stevie said. Really? I don't know.
Larry studied her face for a moment, then seemed to accept her answer. Stevie felt like she was gently hovering over the scene, like in a recurring dream she had in which she floated from room to room of a neighbor's house, watching them do mundane things, a ghost in someone else's home.
What are we going to do?
She asked. Again, what a weird question. Inside, Stevie could think. Outside, Stevie was hugging herself and saying weird things.
I'm going to take you back to Minerva,
Larry said. They said nothing as they drove back. Ellingham Academy rolled past her, looking like movie footage. Nothing was real. There was a far-off noise, a rupture in the air. Larry leaned forward and looked up as the lights of a helicopter appeared overhead and landed on the green. The ambulance had come, but the patient was gone. She had wanted to see a dead body, but not this, not a real someone. Not sneakers upturned at the end of those legs, the legs that had been squatting so stupidly on Stevie's floor only days before. The kneecaps, the patelli, the real human who was now still and cold and somewhere behind them in the dark. When they arrived at Minerva, Larry told Stevie to wait a moment, so she waited. He spoke to Pix just outside the door. Stevie saw Pix put her hand over her mouth as she got the news, and then she came over to the cart and grabbed Stevie's hands.
I'm okay, Stevie said.
Stevie.
Larry leaned in from the driver's side, his hand on the roof of the cart.
I'm going to ask you not to say anything to anyone else in the house right now. Just for a little bit. Do you understand?
You don't want to cause panic and you need to keep the area clear to investigate what happened,
Stevie said.
That's right,
Larry said.
That's real good, Stevie.
Stevie?
Pix said,
I'll take you up to my rooms. If you take me upstairs, the others will know,
Stevie said.
I'll just go to my room. I'm okay, I can do this.
Larry nodded.
She's doing good,
he said.
You just go to your room and get into bed, Stevie. Just stay there and I'll be back for you in a while. We'll need you again.
Stevie tested the ground before she stepped out of the cart and found that her legs were steady. She resisted Pix's offer of an arm around her shoulders. Once inside, the common room now seemed very bright. The wall vibed red, and the moose on the wall seemed grotesque. Janelle had gone, but Ellie and David were still on the sofa, their feet facing each other, laughing at something. They stopped when Pix and Stevie came in.
What's up? Ellie said. Is Hayes in trouble?
No,
Pix said quietly. David was looking at Stevie. She saw him peeling away her blank expression and attempting to go through her thoughts.
I'm heading for bed, Stevie said, turning away.
David followed her with his eyes. Then she heard his phone chirp.
Someone saw a helicopter,
he said to Pix.
I thought I heard something weird, Ellie said.
Pix, is there a helicopter landing?
David asked.
It's fine,
Pix said. Stevie hurried to her room and shut the door. She leaned against it, her head banging against the hook. A wave of nausea passed over her, and she moved to the trash can in preparation, but it passed. She climbed into bed fully dressed and pulled the comforter up around her. Six had gone up the mountain, and then there were five.
Maybe she would go to sleep.
Shock. She was slipping into it. She sat up straight. Paper. She needed paper now. She went to her desk and snatched her anatomy notebook. She needed to write everything down, now, fresh. What had she seen? What did she know? Just write down everything, plain, without thinking about what any of it could have meant. There was a knock at her door, and it creaked open before she could reply.
Hey,
David said. There was no humor in his face now.
What's going on?
I can't, Stevie said, bending over her notebook, her brow furrowed.
What are you doing?
Can't talk.
What?
He said. It messes with your memory, she said impatiently.
Something is going on,
he said.
There are only a few reasons they send a helicopter. You also looked like you just had 3 pints of blood removed. What the hell is happening?
I can't, she said. I need to write it down now. Stories can change accidentally once you start to talk, so I can't talk. Please just shut the door. There was a faint tremble in her hand. She balled it into a fist to steady it and jammed it under the covers. David backed away slowly, closing the door behind him. Stevie pressed on her mind. Just list it. What did you see, Stevie? She let herself write. It started Thursday. Moved ramp and supplies to the garden. Set up fog machines. More granular, Stevie, put it in order. A few nights before, we went into the tunnel.
No.
I broke the lock to get in. There was noise outside and in. She heard the drone of the helicopter as it flew away, the sound of voices from the common room. She put on headphones to muffle them. The information was traveling, and soon everything would be chaos. She had to get her thoughts together now. When she was sure she had recorded all she knew, she ripped out the page. Then she got up, removed her red coat from the closet, and put it on, taking refuge in the stiff vinyl. She put one Ativan in the left pocket and the folded list in the right. Then she sat on the edge of her bed, hands on her lap, until Larry came for her. It was maybe an hour later. Stevie wasn't sure. Time was slippery now. Stevie passed through the common room like a ghost, not looking at the others. Outside, there seemed to be red and blue lights everywhere, winking through the trees, echoing into the sky and throwing strange shadows all around. The temperature felt like it had dropped about 10 degrees. Nate was waiting outside with Pix. He looked blank and gray. Larry drove Stevie and Nate to the great house. He and Stevie sat side by side behind Larry in the cart, taking a bit of warmth from each other. A state police cruiser was parked under the portico, and the officer inside was entering information into the computer. There were more officers inside. Several faculty members were crowded on the balcony, looking down. Maris and Dash were already in the hall, sitting by the massive fireplace. Maris was sobbing, and Dash was glazed over, staring at his phone.
I think I may throw up,
Nate said. Deep breaths, Stevie said, taking his hand. With me. She sat down with Nate on the bottom step of the grand staircase. The trick, Stevie said, is to make the exhale longer than the inhale, so we're going to breathe in for 4, hold for 7, out for 8. Do it with me. I'll count. 1, 2, 3, 4. Nate breathed with Stevie, slowing the response, slowing the fear. This was the funny thing about Stevie's anxiety. When she encountered someone else who felt more anxious than she did, she leveled out. She'd first made this discovery a few years ago, when she got trapped on an elevator with another person in a hotel on one of the few Bell family vacations. The hotel was 20 stories high. Stevie and another woman got on at the 18th floor. The doors closed and the elevator went down, then the car dropped suddenly about a story, juddered, and stopped. Stevie's heart almost flew out of her mouth, but when she saw the woman cry out and sink into the corner of the elevator in panic, something new set in. The woman spent the next half hour sitting on the floor in the corner, half in tears, shaking. Stevie talked her through it, and when they were rescued, the woman had nothing but good things to say about Stevie and bought her a giant cupcake and a coffee from the cafe in the lobby. This might be her future. Talking to people who had just witnessed traumatic events, she would have to work with them, calm them, get them to a place where they could talk. Nate, Stevie said, taking his hand again. What's your favorite book?
What?
Just tell me your favorite book. Don't think about it too hard. Just name a book you like.
The Hobbit.
What do you like about it?
Stevie asked.
I like the whole thing.
But name one thing. Close your eyes and think about The Hobbit for one moment and tell me what you like. Nate closed his eyes. His face smoothed just a bit.
The round door,
he said.
On Bilbo's house. I read it when I was little and I always thought about the door.
That's great, Stevie said. Keep that door in your mind. Keep Bilbo in there. Let's breathe again. Four in, seven hold, eight out. After another moment, Stevie saw Nate settle a bit more. His shoulders relaxed a bit, and the strain of trying not to be sick let up. He exhaled one last time, opened his eyes, and looked at her.
Okay,
he said, nodding.
Okay. What's going to happen? What's happening? Stevie, what the hell is happening?
They'll ask us what we saw, Stevie said.
I didn't see anything. I don't even know what's going on. They said Hayes is dead?
I mean how the day went, Stevie said. They need to establish the facts.
But what happened? How did Hayes die?
I don't know, Stevie said, though in her mind's eye she was looking at the hatch door again. She felt it in her hand, the weight of it as she balanced on the thin rung rail of the ladder. But it's important we don't try to make anything up. Just be clear, just say what you know.
That's good advice.
Larry was standing in front of them. He squatted down and looked Nate over, then looked to Stevie and nodded his approval.
This one here has a good head on her shoulders. The police need to go over the events.
One of the troopers called Nate's name and summoned him into the front parlor. Larry sat on the step next to Stevie.
How you doing?
He asked. I wrote some of it down, Stevie said, showing him the notes. As fresh as I could. Larry read the page carefully. Stevie followed his eyes as they went to each line.
This is good,
he said, passing it back.
You're handling this well.
Do you know what happened? Stevie asked. Larry shook his head. Don't know, Stevie said, or can't say.
They're ready for you,
an officer said, stepping up to Stevie and guiding her into the security office. Here she was, watching a case up close, giving a statement. Experiencing all the things she so longed to experience. All it took was for someone to die. 17. The police kept Stevie about a half hour. The questions were exactly what Stevie expected. Run through the order of the day. Who went where and what time? What was Hayes doing in the tunnel? The collection of information, she knew, needs to be clinical. Don't assume, don't get friendly. Ask the questions, establish the timeline, record accurately and quickly. She tried to keep her answers clear, short but complete. No embellishments, no editorializing on what it all meant. When she was done, Larry was waiting with Nate so they could drive back to Minerva. As the three of them stepped outside, a crime scene processing van made its way onto the property. This caught Stevie short for a moment and gave her a quick surge of panic. She thought again of the hatch. But it was very likely that all death scenes where the cause wasn't immediately clear had to be processed. The moon was thin like a hook, and the owls were calling. The smell of fall leaves blew on the wind, and Hayes was dead. They returned to a very wakeful Minerva. There was a kind of a suctioning sensation as she and Nate entered, like they vacuumed the conversation out of the air.
Oh my God, Janelle said, hurrying to Stevie and hugging her. Are you okay? Oh my God, is he really dead? Stevie, what happened?
Over Janelle's shoulder, Stevie looked at Ellie and David. They were hunched up together on the corner of the purple sofa. Ellie was largely in a ball. Not crying, but vacant. David sat close to her, his arm draped gently over her shoulder. Nate started to giggle.
What the hell are you laughing about? Ellie snapped.
I have no idea, Nate said.
It's shock, El, Pix said. Just laugh, Nate. You can't help how you react.
Nate started laughing harder, and then he started to hiccup. Stevie felt the sleepiness descending hard now. She was utterly calm, just very tired.
I'm going to bed, she said simply.
Back in her room, Stevie found that she was moving with very slow, precise motions. Most nights she just pulled off her clothes and threw them into her laundry sack. Tonight, she hung her coat carefully, pulled each arm delicately out of her shirt, removed her pants as if they were fragile. She rolled everything and dropped it carefully into the bag, then dug the warm school-issue pajamas from the bottom of the dresser and put them on. She climbed into bed, lights on, and stared straight ahead, gripping her phone as if waiting for it to ring. No one was going to call. It was just something to hold. She had no idea how much time had gone by when there was a quiet knock on her door. At first, she decided to ignore it, but then she pushed herself up and opened it. Somehow, she knew it would be David.
"Your light was on,"
he said quietly.
"Can I come in?"
She blinked and rubbed her neck, then shrugged and left the door hanging open. He came in and shut it. Stevie sat on the floor against the foot of her bed. He leaned against the wall. His hair had been tamed a bit, and his expression was unusually serious.
"Do you know what happened?"
he asked. "I know he's dead," she said. "That's it." David drew his lips inward in thought and rubbed his hands together for a moment. He paced over to Stevie's bureau and drummed his fingers on the edge for a moment. He didn't seem to be focusing much on anything. He slid down to the floor. Stevie stared at the lower half of his sweatpants, which seemed like a safe place to stare. They were very old and may have once been deep navy blue. Now they were washed out blue-gray with the word Yale on the leg in cracked white lettering.
"Why did you say that before? About not talking?"
he finally asked.
"Because witnesses are unreliable," she replied.
"You think people will lie?"
"No," she said. "It's not that. It's that people don't know what they remember. It's not that people lie so much as people are just wrong about what they think they see. Humans are bad at estimating time, distance, and duration of events, especially when scared or stressed, and it's all a lot worse in the dark. But one of the worst things is when witnesses start talking to each other. As soon as you start talking to someone else, the story you have in your head changes. Human memory is rewritten like computer memory. You just get the most updated file, which is why if you see some kind of accident, you should record what you experienced right away without speaking to anyone else. That's going to be your clearest account. You may still be off, but you won't start baking in mistakes." The explanation ran smoothly from her lips as if she had been waiting her entire life to deliver it to someone. It arrived fully formed. Now that she was talking about crime more hypothetically, her body warmed a bit and her senses returned.
"What?"
David said.
Stevie looked around for a way to explain. The only objects she had to use for examples were pens and paper clips. They would do. She pulled off some caps. "Say there's a robbery," she said, "and there's a getaway car and a bunch of robbers with guns. Witness one may then recall three robbers, two with masks and one with a hat, and a black car." She set down one black pen cap and two paper clips. "Witness two may remember four robbers, all with masks and a blue car." She added two paper clips and replaced the black cap with a blue one. "And maybe they thought they saw a motorcycle." She pushed a roll of tape past. "Witness three is sure it was three robbers," she went on, taking away a paperclip. "One wore a mask and a hat, and the car was green. I don't have a green cap, so... anyway. Witness three is sure of what he saw. That's a big deal. People who think they have good memories are sometimes the least reliable but the most likely to sway others. And that witness then says that the motorcycle was with the green car."
"Is that the tape?"
David asked.
"And the green car is that blue cap?"
"The point is," Stevie said, "now that witness one has talked to witness three and witness three seems really sure about what they saw, witness one may now think back and see three robbers in hats, not masks. Witness two now questions the masks and thinks the car was green, and one robber was very tall. Witness three claims they were all tall. And suddenly everyone starts to say that they were all tall and that the motorcycle was with the green car." David inched closer and examined the pile. He had gotten very close, actually.
"Okay,"
he said quietly.
But what actually happened?
What?
Was it 3 or 4 robbers? He asked. Was the car blue, black, or green? Was there a motorcycle involved?
The point is, Stevie repeated.
And which witness was this?
He asked, reaching for a paperclip. He pressed it into her palm. His hand was warm. Had she really just seen Hayes's body on the ground in that tunnel? She had seen the soles of a pair of shoes, his mottled skin. Don't think about that. Don't make it real. Something else was coming into her head instead. Well, not her head, other parts of her. Her mind was quickly being stripped of rational thoughts. She and David were micro-positioning themselves closer. An inch here, an inch there. Was this really going to happen? The last foot of space between them was rapidly closed up, and David pressed his lips to hers. She felt her body relax, and a warm ease fell over her. She let herself rest against the floor, and David came over as well, supporting himself with an elbow. He was kissing her very gently, his lips pressing on her neck, tickling her ear, and she was kissing back harder, hungrily. He rested on the floor, and she surprised herself by rolling on top of him. Everything in her brain was saying, "Don't do this. It would be a mess." It was David, and there was something about him that was so off, and he lived upstairs, and someone had just died. She'd seen a body. But that was the thing that was also pushing her forward, probably. The thing that was filling her with some weird, urgent emotion, and the need to do something, anything, anything at all. She kissed the strange crook of his nose, his high forehead, and back to his mouth. They changed positions, rolling forward to the fireplace. Stevie felt her back hit her caseboard and knew the cardboard was probably bending a little, and she didn't care. She didn't care if the floor opened up and swallowed her or if she was sucked up the chimney. Her hands were in his hair, and he was mumbling something that she couldn't quite make out.
Hey!
That was a totally different voice, and it was coming from the doorway. The two of them stopped rolling. Neither moved for a moment. Stevie realized she was sweating and David was out of breath, his heart pulsing above hers. Stevie tipped her head back and looked at the upside-down figure of Pix.
"I think maybe you should go back to your room," she said, not unkindly.
"Yep,"
David replied, rolling off Stevie gently and standing up, his back to Pix.
"Yep, I'll do that now."
Pix stepped out into the hall and allowed David to pass.
"You should try to get some sleep," Pix said once David was gone. "Do you need anything?"
"Nope," Stevie said, her voice high and strange. "I'm good, thanks, Pix."
"Okay, I'm just upstairs."
Stevie remained where she was for a moment, staring up at the ceiling where a moth was helplessly slamming itself into the light. Then, very slowly and very deliberately, she struck the back of her head against the wooden floor. Federal Bureau of Investigation, interview between Agent Samuel Arnold and Flora Robinson, April 17, 1936, 12:45 p.m. Location, Ellingham Property. S.A.
"I'd like to go over what happened on Monday, is that all right?"
F.R. Of course. S.A.
"You've been here at the Ellingham house for 2 weeks now, since April 4th?
F.R. Yes. S.A.
"You come to visit regularly?"
F.R. Yes. S.A.
"And you live in New York City, that's how you know Mrs. Ellingham?"
F.R. We met 9 years ago. S.A.
"Where did you meet?"
F.R. At a social occasion. S.A.
"What sort of social occasion, Miss Robinson?"
F.R. At a literary salon. S.A.
A literary salon?
F.R. Yes. S.A.
Where was this literary salon?
F.R. In New York City. S.A.
Was this a drinking establishment, Miss Robinson?
F.R. Why is that important? S.A.
We just need to build a picture of Mrs. Ellingham's contacts,
We want to know if she might have met someone somewhere who would want to hurt her. Alcohol isn't against the law anymore, and no one cares what happened 9 years ago.
F.R. I assure you, this establishment was full of the best people.